Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Richard Skipper celebrates the best in entertainment. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique, never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Monday, everyone. And welcome to a very special edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. For those of you who are here for the first time, my show is all about celebrating. It's about celebrating life, celebrating art, celebrating artists. And we have a lot to celebrate if we only take the time to do so. And especially in these dark times, we need to find the celebration in every corner that we can find. And tonight, we're going to be celebrating a lot. We're going to be celebrating Karen Carpenter. We are going to be celebrating Randy Schmidt, who I have to tell you, I have been reading this amazing book, celebrating the legacy of Karen Carpenter. Randy, I am so thrilled that you were here tonight. And as we look back on Karen's life and legacy and her art, I also want to celebrate you and the fact that you spent 8 years working on this book, and it didn't stop when this book ended up published. It still goes on to this day, and I thank you for that. But before we delve into all of this, I want to talk about you and where that life all began for you. I want to go back a little bit. First of all, how are you doing really in the crazy world we're in right now?
Well, I just started my 25th year of teaching elementary school. I teach elementary music, kindergarten through fifth grade. So ask any teacher right now, teaching during a pandemic is quite challenging. Last year, though, we weren't able to sing or play instruments or do anything except talk at music and talk about music. So this year, we're at least able to make music through masks, and they've lifted a few of the things that were keeping us from you know, really making music. So doing better this school year for that reason alone, just because, you know, the joy of teaching kids music is seeing them make it and seeing them have those moments with music. And last year, I think it was discouraging for a lot of them, just like it was for the grownups.
And where did your joy of music begin for you? I mean, did you grow up in a household surrounded by music?
I think my earliest musical influence was probably my grandma Margie. Mm-hmm. And she was either singing or humming or whistling at just about every moment she was awake. And I think she was the first person who really sparked that love for music for me. And then shortly thereafter introduced me to Dolly Parton, like any good grandma should do.
Absolutely.
And so I think Dolly was my first musical love, and not necessarily a musical family though that I came from, but mainly my grandma. And then that picked up from elementary music, which is kind of what inspired me to do what I do today. My elementary music teacher, a woman named Joanne Carlson, who's no longer with us, mm-hmm. but she really sparked that interest in me to want to teach music and want to get, voice lessons and to explore the choral music world throughout my middle school and, well, junior high back then, my junior high and high school years.
Now, I'm a little bit older than you are. So when you, yeah, I am. So when you were listening to music, what was the medium that you were listening to music on or through as a young kid?
I remember sitting next to the speakers, the foam speakers of my grandma's stereo, and it was a lot of 8-tracks and some LPs. I was born right we're talking about the Carpenters, of course, and Karen. I was born right in the middle of the Carpenters' heyday and missed it the first time around. So I had a lot of catching up to do with that. But yeah, it was eight tracks for a while, and you know, I still know where the tracks would be continued on certain Dolly Parton songs, you know, where they would skip to the next track and continue with the song.
Well, one of my first eight track tapes was Rainy Days and Mondays. I grew up on a farm in South Carolina, 1971, when that song hit. I worked on a tobacco farm, believe it or not, even at 10 years old. And my uncle had a Mustang. How's that for bringing back memories? And they would bring the Mustang up near the tobacco farm, and they would play this, and we would all listen to the Carpenters playing throughout the day. And we're going to go back and talk about the Carpenters and the evolution of Karen's career in a few moments. But I want to ask you, because it's all about siblings, Karen and Richard, do you have any brothers and sisters?
I do. I have a sister named Rhonda. And it's interesting, you know, you and I probably have more in common than we thought, because I did grow up on a farm in Western Oklahoma, actually. So, but yeah, Rhonda and I both grew up on this farm a few miles east of town. And she was the horse girl and the farming girl. Like, she was into all that. And I remember a time, this is how much I loved music. I traded her my horse for her record player. So that explains a lot. And I never regretted it.
Sounds a little bit like Richard and Karen when you think about it.
Right.
Yeah. So I want to ask, I mean, what's the dynamics of you and your sister? Are you older? Is she older?
You know, it's actually about the same age difference as Richard and Karen. I was, I'm 4 years older than her. And yeah, she was always, you know, she was the one that was like the rodeo queen or the rodeo princess in our town, and was into the Roundup Club and all that stuff that my dad did. And I was the one nerding out to whatever, you know, the latest craze was. Not the latest craze for normal people, but for me.
Mm-hmm. What's normal?
What is normal? What's normal anyway?
So when I was doing my research, I think I read somewhere that you were around 13 when you first discovered the Carpenters. Am I correct?
That's right, yeah.
So what was it about the Carpenters that first pulled you in? Of course, it was this voice of Karen's. It has to be.
Absolutely. It was the voice that pulled me in, and it was the TV movie about Karen's life. And I think it was the combination of seeing her story unfold visually before me and having such empathy and such just such a longing to help her in some way. And of course, you know, you couldn't, but there was something in her voice that matched that. There was that same longing, that same reaching out. And I've never had another voice capture me in the same way. You know, there are a lot of voices I love and voices that can give me chills or whatever, but there's never been one that's connected on the same almost soul level. There's never been another voice like that for me. And I don't
think let's talk about three voices that you've written about: Judy Garland, Dolly Parton, and Karen Carpenter. Right. But Karen Carpenter is the voice that you keep going back to over and over and over again. You know, she's a contralto. What is it for you that her voice still resonates so strongly today? And I think that there is more of a resurgence of her voice now. As we speak, and I know that Katie Neheisel is watching, she's about to do a show that's about to open in New York, celebrating the music of Karen Carpenter. Yes. There are several shows that are tribute shows that are still playing, both with impersonations and just celebrating the music of Karen Carpenter and Richard Carpenter as well. What is it about their music that you think still resonates so strongly in today's world?
Well, I think that the Carpenters made such perfect pop songs that, and they were the soundtrack for a generation. And I think a lot of it is those memories tied to it. But then for people like me that came along, and I don't necessarily have, you know, a memory of this song being played at, you know, graduation or that song at a wedding or whatever, it was that connection with Karen. And the fact that she had this ability to not perform a song, she was never one to, you know, say, you know, stand back, I'm going to wow you kind of thing. It was the opposite of that that did the wowing. It was the fact that it was so simple and so organic and just so pure. And she was a conversational singer. You know, she spoke and sang directly to the listener. And Carpenters fans worldwide and for many, many years will argue that, you know, she was singing only to me kind of thing. And I think that's part of what it was. I felt like, you know, I said before that she was reaching out. Her voice was trying to tell something that was more than just that song. I think there's a lot of undertone to it. And, you know, people will tell me, well, that's because you're listening to it in hindsight. We didn't know or feel that necessarily when these songs were being released. But wow, it spoke to me on so many levels and still does. I've never had anybody that I've just gone back to. I mean, and then I never get tired of.
So were you weren't really that familiar with her music until you started delving deeper after you saw the TV movie?
Right.
And it was the TV movie that really pulled you in.
Yeah, it was. It aired on January 1st, 1989. Not that I remember dates, but mm-hmm. Yeah, it was kind of a big deal. And from the opening strains of Rainy Days and Mondays, I was already hooked. And like I said, seeing that unfold, that tragic story with these songs as the soundtrack, it was, you know, it was captivating. And I was immediately, you know, drawn to it. And I wanted to learn everything that I could, everything that I had missed. I think it was the next day or two after that I was in my local library and started, I guess you could say, started the research that became this book many, many years later.
Right. But, now, you have something also at your, I mean, not necessarily at that time to the effect that you had it much later, but you had the ability of having social media. You really started connecting with other Carpenters fans really early on.
Well, you know, that came along a little later. I wish that I had had that, because 1989, of course, is when the movie came out. And it wasn't until mm-hmm. around 94, 95 that I really started connecting with Carpenters fans online. So there were those few years where I still kind of thought that I was the only fan. And then when we all started to find each other online, everybody was like, oh, you too. And then we realized that there was just this huge following, and everybody from people who heard them on the radio in 1969 with Ticket to Ride. And then of course, Close to You brought in the most fans, I'm sure. But then these resurgences, there was the TV movie that brought me and other people around my age to the Carpenters. And then it seems like every, you know, 4 or 5 years, there's been something else that has prompted that renewed interest. And, you know, luckily my book was that for a lot of people. And then there have been other.
I mean, I have to say, I mean, it's an amazing book, but you are also an amazing writer. And I want to celebrate that with you as well. But in the trajectory of your books, was this the first book or were there other books that came prior to this?
I had put together, I had compiled and edited a book of Carpenter's articles and interviews and concert reviews. And, you know, it was a small publication. I think the guy had a publishing house out of his garage, much like the Carpenters got their start in a garage studio. But, you know, they published, I think, 1,000 copies or something. And it was super hard to find for anybody back then. And that was really, I didn't have enough confidence in my writing at that point to feel like I could write a book. I felt pretty comfortable compiling and editing that one and was pleased with how it turned out. But I kind of thought that might be my only entrance into the publishing world. I mm-hmm. thought I would probably move on and do other things. But it, I don't know. I've always loved to write. I just didn't know that it would necessarily be something that I could do for life, you know?
Well, I want to talk about the process of writing a book, especially writing a book about someone's life like this. It's one thing to be a fan. It's one thing to start to compile these stories. It's another thing to commit yourself the way that you did. Mm-hmm. This is an unauthorized biography. What were the obstacles that you faced early on as you embarked on this journey?
I think the first obstacles were really just what kind of book I wanted to create and what approach I was going to take. You know, I had done this compilation of all these things, but I kept waiting for someone to write the book that I wanted to read. And this following of Carpenters fans that I was helping to kind of assemble online with different fan groups and that sort of thing were very encouraging. And I quickly found myself kind of the Karen Carpenter guru on the internet. And I got the opportunity to interview a few people, some childhood friends of Karen's, and I had no idea what I was going to do with the finished tape. You know, I just wanted to talk with them and learn more about her, and I'd figure out later what I was going to do with it. And as I would talk with other fans and things over the years, they'd say, well, how do you know that? And I'd say, oh, well, you know, I interviewed so-and-so and they told me this or that. And people started to say, gosh, you should write a book. And, oh, no, I'm waiting on, you know, so-and-so, they're the expert or whatever. And then finally you realize that when you've done all this work, you do kind of become the expert. You know, shortly after Little Girl Blue, the Karen book was published, I asked another author, because he said, what's your next book? And I said, you know, I'm not really an expert on anything else. And he says, you do the work, you become the expert. You get in there, you dig into it, you find things that other people haven't, you research places that, you know, leave no stone unturned, and you become the expert because of that. And so I really, you know, I give that advice to other people now when they ask, because it just takes the work of doing it. The, you know, this book had well over 100 interviews by the time it was finished. And
over the course of 8 years.
Yeah. And, you know, I would kind of put it back on the shelf here and there throughout that time, because, you know, life happens. And whenever you're teaching full time and writing gig is sort of a side thing, you know, more of a hobby at that time, you do have to kind of, you might put it on the shelf for 6 months and then something else, you know, another interview will come along and spur you back into it. And that's how it was for me.
So as you started to write the book, the first interview that you got, and then we're going to start delving in, we're going to go over the timeline of Karen's life. Mm-hmm. What was the first interview that you got and you went, wow, this is really happening?
Well, the very first one was her childhood friend, a lady by the name of Debbie Cudicello, who grew up with Karen in New Haven. And mm-hmm. We connected. She at that time was a first grade mm-hmm. Elementary school teacher. So we connected on that. She knew that I was, you know, just starting out my teaching career at that point. And I think for that reason alone, she trusted me like teacher to teacher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then after that, that just kind of was the only one for a while until shortly after the book of the compilation book, Yesterday Once More is what it was called, Memories of the Carpenters and Their Music. Shortly after that came out, it started to open a few doors. You know, when you reach out to somebody, if you aren't the author of something already, or you don't have any clout in that way, sometimes it's hard to get people to visit with you. And just the fact that you have had a publication raises that to a new level. And finally, you have something you can say when you either call these people or reach out by email. And, you know, it was little by little after that. A lot of them were Karen's friends or associates, people who recorded with them, producers on television shows that they did. And, you know, I of course reached out to Richard at one point. I'd met him several times and he was familiar with me because of my online Carpenters presence and the different groups and things that I had organized online, and a convention that we had actually for fans of the Carpenters back in 1999, which he attended. At that point, the book wasn't necessarily going to be about Karen. I was just looking to do another Carpenters book of some kind. And I had seen this great book on the Mamas and the Papas. It was an oral history. And I thought, okay, that's, again, something that I could do that's not like full on. I wrote this book, but I researched it. I talked to these people, and now I'm going to assemble their thoughts and their, you know, comments on different things. And that's how it really began. And when I reached out to Richard at the time, through his manager at that point, the response that came back was that Richard has said all he wants to say having to do with Karen's personal life. And I said, well, you know, this is a celebration of the music. I want to just talk about the music and the legacy. We can keep it totally on that subject. And he politely declined even that approach. So after that, it began to grow because of Richard's absence, if that makes sense. You know, for a while, certain people wouldn't talk to you if they were in Richard's close camp. You know, you've got the Herb Alperts and John Bettis and some of these people that are, you know, super tight with Richard. And unless Richard says, yes, do this, they won't. And some of the band members and things like that would reach out to Richard. And from what I understood is that he was saying, well, you know, I'm not endorsing this, but do what you want. And so we did get a few people that, you know, I talked with Tony Peluso, who was the Carpenters guitarist. Mm-hmm. So I got several people that told me, you know, Richard's not saying don't do this, but then he's not, of course, endorsing it in any way either. But after certain interviews, and there was especially one that really got my attention, there was a guy by the name of Barry Morrow, who was the screenwriter for the TV movie that I had seen, you know, as a kid. Mm-hmm. And he was well known for several TV movies at that time, and then went on to win the Oscar for Rain Man shortly after the Karen Carpenter story. And it was that conversation with him that made me realize the book took a turn somewhere with that conversation. The things he was telling me about the family and about the previous efforts to I guess whitewash the story.
And your book, you chose to open your book with that.
Yeah, that's you know, the author's note that opens with mm-hmm. really the scene that he gave me that I think paints such a vivid picture of kind of the family dynamics and who we're dealing with here. You know, he went for his first interview with Agnes Carpenter, which was Karen's mother. Mm-hmm. And this was about a little over a year after Karen had died. They were already working on this movie. Richard had been talked into it by Jerry Weintraub, his management at the time, basically because they knew that there were these other ideas out there for movies. And if they didn't make it themselves, they wouldn't have any control over it. So they were, that's how Richard got talked into it, begrudgingly. But anyway, Barry Morrow's going to the Carpenter's house, this big, you know, block-long house in Downey, where a lot of people are familiar with that because it was on the cover of their Now and Then album in 1973. But he walks up to the house, rings the doorbell, and their housekeeper opens the door and greets him. And she's pushed out of the way by Agnes Carpenter, who says to Barry, "I want you to know I did not kill my daughter." Mm-hmm. And that's how she invited him into the house. You know, he mm-hmm. very, I guess, tiptoeingly said, "Okay, may I come in?" And you know, they had a nice visit, but he said it was very formal. You know, they had the teapots and everything there ready. It was very surface. And he's told me since then, because I've interviewed him again, he's told me since then that, you know, you would think you knew something about your daughter other than the facts of the music career and things like that, but they wouldn't go there. Like, he wanted to know who Karen was behind the music, and he couldn't get the family to break that almost press release version of who Karen was. you know, the A&M Records press release, exactly. These are the Carpenters, that biography is, that's as far as they wanted to go with it.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because it's this thread that goes throughout your book that here's this family. They were truly a suburban family from New Haven, Connecticut. They moved to California for Richard's career, essentially. They go out there. They live in a very suburban area of California, not in the hot spot of L.A., and they are thrust into this career that takes off once it starts to take off like a bullet. And, you know, and there are these two squeaky, you know, clean kids in the middle of a business that this family is really not prepared for.
And right. It's interesting, too, that when Agnes started to see what was going on and the money started to come in, she was so known to be a control freak. And I mean, I think they had heard so many horror stories about, you know, the Beach Boys and different people that had lost money to management. And even though, you know, they had Herb Alpert and his people kind of watching over and taking care of them, Agnes didn't trust anyone. And so much so that she went around to every bank in town to, you know, deposit this much here and that much there. And she had her own people within the house doing all the books and stuff for a couple of years until management finally came in and said, you know, this is not going to work. They had no sophistication whatsoever to what they were doing. And it was just a mess. And it was all because of this control that Agnes wanted to have over the kids and over, I mean, they had moved to California to further Richard's career. They had done all of this, you know, bought all of these instruments for them on the way up. And, you know, they had done all this so that Richard particularly could be a superstar. And now that was finally happening and she wasn't about to let it go wrong.
Even so much so that as Karen starts coming out of the shadows, literally, I mean, she was in the background, that seemed to get in the way as well.
Yeah, because Richard was always thought to be the superstar in the family. They were sort of grooming him from an early age to be almost like the next Liberace or something of his generation. And Karen showed no interest in anything other than listening to music. You know, she liked to play baseball, and music wasn't her thing other than the music that she and Richard listened to together, because she was that, I guess, typical tag-along sister. My sister, we were speaking of her earlier, she was not a tag-along with me. Maybe more the other way.
Well, my sister and I are actually 13 months apart. And the same thing, we were not tag-alongs. We were very opposite. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they literally were together 24/7.
Right. And it started from, they grew up, those formative years in New Haven, they were listening to the same records, part of their father's record collection in the basement. He even hung swings in the basement so that they could swing and listen to the music year round. And, you know, Richard started playing the piano and then became obviously, you know, it was more than just he was good at piano. You know, he went and studied with a professor at Yale while they were still in New Haven. So They wanted to move to Hollywood, not to Hollywood. They wanted to move to Los Angeles because of its proximity to Hollywood.
Right.
And Karen was kind of the musical accident of the family. Like, nobody knew she could do anything. And it started with the drumming in high school. And the drumming and the voice sort of started to come along at the same time. She started to sing. But even then, it wasn't seen as she was really that good. The family didn't think she was going to be anything necessarily other than maybe support for Richard, because now, you know, she could drum with his trio. She could be the drummer for his group, or now she could be the voice to do demos for the songs that he was writing. But the focus was still on Richard, even though Karen was starting to emerge as, you know, a great talent of her own.
Well, she was still tagging along just to, you know, appease Richard, exactly. You know, for no other reason but to be along. But, you know, it's very interesting. The people that they were meeting along the way, and it was almost as if there was a fairy godmother, if you will, you know, tapping them on the shoulder with putting the right people in their paths along the way, even, with Herb Albert, you know, with their first album, which was not a big hit. If you can take us there for a moment. And yeah. Even though the album was not a hit and everyone's saying, you know, cut your losses and let them go, unheard of. But he would say, well, there's something there. I want to give them a second chance.
Right. Yeah. The first album, the only thing that raised any interest whatsoever was that single Ticket to Ride, which made it to 54 on the Billboard Hot 100, which is, I mean, that's a pretty big deal, but it wasn't enough for them. And it wasn't enough for A&M Records to necessarily hold on to them. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have, you know, the next album ready to go or anything like that. So Herb basically said, you know, go in and cut a few songs and let's see what we can do next with this, because it was such a unique sound. And A&M was such a unique family type of a label that they were willing to take chances on things that other labels would have never given any time to at all. And Carpenters had gone, you know, all over LA shopping their demo tape, and pretty much everybody had heard it in town. And it took somebody like Herb Alpert, you know, who is a musician himself and who clued into something with Karen's voice that, you know, this is special. And he always says it reminded him of, you know, Patti Page or some of those voices that have such presence and such depth. And so luckily he did, because the difference between that first album and even that first single, Ticket to Ride, and what happened within the next year, I mean, Karen really found her place in that short amount of time.
Just by changing an octave.
Well, she was still singing low, even on
Ticket to Ride. Really finding her voice, right. You know, in just something that simple. And everyone going, wow, where has that been all this time? I mean, it was there. They were hearing it. But I want to talk a little bit about, you know, this whole shift in their lives and everything with the time frame of the world of music at that era. Mm-hmm. Because if you listen, everything's fragmented now. But I remember Saturday afternoon, Casey Kasem, everyone across the country, every FM channel was listening to the same music. Mm-hmm. And their next song, which you're going to take us to, it started just slowly creeping up the charts. And bam.
Right. Well, and this was a time that, you know, rock music was getting harder, and there was this acid rock surrounding them everywhere. And there had been some folk sounds and stuff in the mid 60s and some pop sounds, you know, with Mamas and Papas and Beach Boys and stuff that might be considered somewhat in the same vein as the Carpenters, but that's not where music was necessarily moving. Carpenters always had sort of an air of nostalgia to their music, because it seemed to nod back to the pop music of the 40s and 50s. And so it wasn't trendy in any way whatsoever, especially in, you know, the summer of 1970. Mm-hmm. And then out emerges this voice that was sort of opposed to all of those other things. It was sort of in contradiction to the sounds that everybody was hearing everywhere else. And I think sometimes I think of it as a teacher. There are times that a class might be, I'm saying it because I'm here in my classroom, and so I can think about that right now. There are times that the kids may be crazy and out of control or whatever, and if I just, you know, yelled over them or whatever, I'm not going to get their attention. But give them something to lean into and something to really latch onto and make them listen to what you're saying. You know, whisper. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what Karen Carpenter was to the chaos of the early 70s. Mm-hmm. People leaned in and listened because it was so different and it was so unique. And then that first song, Close to You, which had been, you know, a Bacharach song that had been recorded by, you know, a handful of people, but it had never been a hit, was now all at once 4 weeks at number one. And everybody was talking about, who's this group? And they still didn't have an album to promote it with yet. It was like, what do we do next? So luckily they had just discovered We've Only Just Begun around that same time. And I mean, follow up Close to You with We've Only Just Begun. And of course,
from a commercial.
from a bank commercial in Southern California.
Inspiration. It can come from anywhere.
Well, that speaks to, I think that's one of the places that Richard was so strong in all of this, is that he was a good A&R man. Like, he knew when he heard a song that's something we could make really spectacular. And he took, you know, okay and good songs and made them really great because of his arranging abilities and just his abilities to pick songs from unusual places.
Well, you know, writing this book and the people that you've met along the way and everything, what has surprised you the most about the Carpenters in terms of the legacy of their, I like to refer to it as their body of worth. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate thing is that her tragic end overshadows the work and the worth a lot of times. And I'm glad that you too focus on the work. What do you think is the biggest misconception that people have now and that they tend to forget as far as her body of worth is concerned?
Well, I think sometimes people consider the Carpenters' music as being simple and you know, not having that much depth to it. And it's because they were so good at what they did that the music does, maybe at first listen, have a simplicity to it because it is so perfectly done. But when you start to dissect the music and really listen to the layers and what all is going on, I mean, even just Karen's voice, as I mentioned before, there's not just that surface. You hear the initial voice at first, but then there are so many undertones to it. And one of Karen's friends told me, her name is Frenda. I'm sure we'll talk about her at some point. But Frenda was one of several of Karen's girlfriends that came out and really helped this book, helped push me to the finish line with it. And she said that she wanted me to know the many layers of Karen, because I think people think that she was this just one trick pony or something mm-hmm. like that, that she was just a 70s pop songstress. But I think that there's something about Karen that sets her apart from almost every other vocalist of her decade. And it puts her in a different category that's up there with the greats like the Ella Fitzgeralds mm-hmm. and the Frank Sinatras. It's on a different level. And as much as I love Helen Reddy, as much as I love Olivia Newton-John and all these other women that were, you know, Karen's contemporaries, none of them come close to the magic that is Karen. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's what it is that elevates that music beyond just simple pop songs and takes it to this other plane, this other plateau that a lot of other 70s music maybe never reaches.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the movie, and I went back and watched the movie again in preparation for this because it had been a while since I had seen it. And in the movie, there's this thing that the anorexia began because of an article that she read about her eating disorder.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in that was not true. It was really based on a lot of the pressure that was being put on her from the people surrounding her and family and friends and everything. Talk about her, the people around her, the pluses, the minuses, looking back in hindsight, the mistakes that were being made, if any help could have really been made at that time to help her.
You know, speaking of that article that you mentioned, the article that never was, there were a lot of things said about Karen and Richard in the press that was hurtful to them and not necessarily that one particular thing. I know the writers of Billboard were pretty upset when they saw that it had been portrayed that way, that, you know, Karen opens a copy of Billboard magazine in this TV movie and says, his chubby sister, you know, and she's shocked to see this comment, and it does kind of make it
never like happened if any of you see the movie.
Right. It's like that was the catalyst for it. And it, when in truth, they were just looking for something to, you know, point to in the TV movie, something maybe other than the relationships and things that probably really did play into that, that began much earlier. There was such a expectation of perfection from her earliest moments. I mean, the fact that, you know, Karen said that Agnes's garage floor was so clean that you could eat off of it. And Agnes would scrub the brass window locks with a toothbrush and then look across and see that her neighbor next door hadn't cleaned their windows in a while. So she would go over there to do it for them. I mean, there's a lot of control and a lot of expectation for perfection from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And especially when Richard comes along and seems to be so perfect in so many ways, there's that expectation for Karen to do the same. And when she falls short, or when she's not what her mother expects of her, when she's not the girly girl that, you know, is how you're supposed to look and how you're supposed to dress and how you're supposed to act in, you know, 1960s Americana, I think that she knew that Agnes was disappointed that she wasn't what, you know, that every little girl was, every other little girl was seemingly being. You know, Karen wasn't the one that wore the frilly dresses and went to, you know, princess dances and things like that. This was...
Well, let's talk about that for just a moment. Richard, from a very early age, took up the piano and had that musicality. He had an ear for it. She took up the drums much later. She didn't even have the drums. She was working on, you know, on the stool and
pots and pans.
And she really developed that sense. And she was excellent on the drums. I mean, she was up there with Buddy Rich, in my opinion, as far as being an excellent drummer. We now know her as this excellent singer. And if you go back and you listen to those early recordings, you really have a sense of how amazing she was as a drummer. Did her family, her mom, Harold and Agnes, really acknowledge her in that department?
It's hard to know what her father did because he was so either silent or silenced. It depends on who you ask. You know, a lot of people that were close to the family said that he was constantly hushed by Agnes. You know, just don't say anything. Let us do the talking or whatever. And I did learn actually after my book came out that right around the time that they had moved to California, Harold had suffered a stroke. And his voice became impaired from that. And it was, you could always see now that I know that, you can see places where Karen would try to help him out, whether it was in a TV special or something. And you know, just to see her kind of take Dad under her wing, it makes more sense now. But I think Agnes wanted Harold just to stay quiet, whether it was always about appearances, you know, in so many different ways, keeping up the appearances, keeping up with the Joneses. That was Agnes's way. And I think Harold kind of got in the way with that. So we really don't know what Harold thought. I'm sure he was encouraging to her. I know that they were both, you know, very supportive parents in just about every way, and wanted them to have all the things they needed to make the music that they were inspired to play or write or whatever. With Agnes, I think that when Karen's talents and stardom started to eclipse Richard's is when it became a real problem, because, you know, Richard was intended to be that superstar from the very beginning. And now, you know, after the first couple of albums, he's not singing on the albums anymore. Karen becomes the voice and the front, especially when they bring her out from behind the drums, which she didn't want really to have anything to do with for a long time. But bringing her out front made her even more the focal point and put Richard, I think, more in the background. And that was hard for Agnes because, you know, it was actually the last time I visited with Barry Morrow, the screenwriter, he said Agnes sort of bet wrong. you know, it was really upsetting for her to see that Karen was getting all the attention.
I mean, what kind of a real strong support system did Karen have outside of her family in terms of, I mean, her relationships? I mean, her marriage was a major bust. Relationships, I'm reading in the book that she would sit in this huge house eating her dinner on a TV tray without even a TV in the house. In this huge house alone, many times, miserable, who were the friends that she was able to get away with?
Right. Which,
you know, she didn't have that.
Well, I mentioned a few minutes ago, a woman by the name of Frenda, and Frenda Leffler, the wife of Ed Leffler, who was, part of the Carpenters management team. And, Frenda took Karen under her wing pretty early on. She saw Karen probably 1970, like right around the time of Close to You, and she was so rough around the edges, which is one of the things I love about Karen, and I wish that they hadn't tried to, I guess, soften those hard edges, because that's really part of who she was. You know, she grew up loving the drums. She talked like a beatnik and a jazzer with the other guys in the band. And she was rough. You know, and Frenda said that she walked across the stage in those days like a Mack truck.
Yes.
Well, my feeling now is let her, you know? I mean, but things were obviously very different in those days. And there was a conscious effort, I think, by everybody around Karen to sort of, I guess, craft her into something that was a little more ladylike in those days, and, you know, how to walk like a lady and talk like a lady. And Frenda was Beverly Hills high society. And so she knew all of those things and could impart that knowledge and that experience onto Karen. But Frenda was somebody that I had reached out to with no response whatsoever for about 6 or 7 years. And because I never got a response and I never got a no or a leave me alone, I kept every year or two just reaching out and explaining where I was in the project and how I would like to visit with her. But it wasn't until after I connected with another of Karen's friends, a woman by the name of Karen Ramone, the wife of Phil Ramone, the record producer, who, you know, is known for his work mostly with Billy Joel and Paul Simon. But he was brought in to produce Karen's one and only solo record in 1979, 1980. And that's when she hit it off with the two Karens, became really good friends. This was before Karen was a bad word. And so now I usually have to say Karen Carpenter so that nobody, anyhow, the two Karens, Karen Ramone and Karen Carpenter, became inseparable. It was after I got to interview Karen Ramone that she started calling up all of Karen's other girlfriends and saying, you know, this is a good guy. He's got good intentions. He's not digging for dirt. He wants the real story, but he's going to be kind to our girl, is basically how in so many words that it went out to those women. And for the first time, I got the response from Frenda. I knew she was important, and everybody who knew Karen well said, well, you've got to talk to Frenda. But Frenda hadn't talked to anybody other than Barry Morrow, who had written the TV movie. Mm-hmm. And everything that Frenda had contributed, or a lot of it, when Richard found out that she was, you know, a big source for him, he kind of shut it down. It wasn't the narrative that he wanted portrayed. And it really didn't get to come out until, I mean, there are parts of it you can see in the movie, knowing Frenda's relationship and how that went down, but it really didn't come out until my book. Mm-hmm. And so when Frenda finally messaged and said she was willing to visit with me, although most of my other interviews had been phone interviews over the years, I got on a plane as quickly as possible and went and spent the day with Frenda in her home. And she was Karen's matron of honor. So it was obvious, especially when you see the pictures of Karen's wedding and there are, you know, a dozen bridesmaids, the fact that this woman ranked up there tells you how important she was to Karen. And she was one of the people, one of the few people that Karen really let her guard down and let know what was going on within the family. Because Karen knew that the expectation was to keep up appearances, and you don't go around saying if things aren't going well with mom or with brother or whatever. But with Frenda, you know, she told everything.
Randy, I always like to ask people when they write a book, when do you know that it's ready to give birth? Is it the editor in your case? Did you know it was ready? When did you know that it was ready to go? And after it was published, it's been 10 years now, mm-hmm. Hasn't it?
Actually 11, the hardcover came out in 2010.
Wow. You know, are there, I mean, do you ever go back and have there been things since the book came out that you would like to revisit?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I don't think that it's ever truly finished. Mm-hmm. You have a deadline and you have people expecting it on this particular timeline, and that really dictates when the book is over. I mean, I still have a folder in my email box that I continuously drag things into in case there's ever, you know, a revised and updated edition or something, because the research never stops. I mean, somebody comes along and he will either correct something that maybe a misassumption that I had all those years ago, or adds to something and, you know, gives you a little bit more perspective and depth to a story. And so it's never really done. It has to be because, you know, timelines and deadlines and that sort of thing. But I don't think it's ever really stopped. And that research has gone on into other projects that I've continued on with. And
now I understand that there is another project coming out of this.
Yeah, actually, you know, there was a book a couple of years ago I want to mention real quick called Carpenters and Illustrated Discography, which is like a coffee table book with lots of, you know, full color photos and over 200 images. And it's just, it turned out so beautiful. And I had a lot of people who joined me in commentary and discussion about the different Carpenters albums through the years. And so it really focuses more on the musical legacy. And but then sort of an extension of Little Girl Blue is a documentary that I've been working on. For the past 2 years, I've been working with AMS Pictures, which is a production company nearby me in Dallas. And the head of the production company had an elevator encounter with Richard and Karen. He happened to be in the same elevator with them at ABC back in the late 70s. And he said there's something about Karen and that encounter, as brief as it was, that's always kind of haunted him. And he's always had a fondness for her music and her story. And so we've been co-producing this and not sure where it's going to end up just yet. I mean, things with these last couple of years of COVID changed things, sometimes for the better, because there is such a huge, I think, hunger for content right now. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know if it's going to, it might end up going and playing some of the film festival. It might go that route. It might go direct to streaming. It might be a TV thing. We don't know yet, but it's about 95% done now, and it's been sent on to the finishing editor. And I'm excited to see where it goes, because it did allow me to dig into some of these stories that, things that I've learned since publishing Little Girl Blue, and to also talk to people that I wasn't able to get back then.
As well, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but when it comes out, will you come back and talk to me?
Oh, I would love to. Yeah, absolutely. You've got so many great voices in there too, and perspectives. I mean, everybody from Carol Burnett. I mean, Carol Burnett talking about Karen Carpenter being funny is just like the greatest. Carney Wilson, who's a big fan, and she talks mm-hmm. about how her dad, you know, the great Brian Wilson, who the Carpenters just idolized, it was him idolizing Karen in return, and how they would listen to the Carpenters albums in the Brian Wilson household when she was a little girl. Kristen Chenoweth, another person that's been inspired by Karen. One of my favorite lines from Kristen in the documentary, she says, when I heard Julie Andrews, you know, spin around on the hill and sing "The Hills Are Alive," I knew that was me. But then I heard Karen singing "Yesterday Once More," and I knew that was me too. And who else? Belinda Carlisle was a big Carpenters fan. We interviewed her for the doc. So people who knew them, like Cubby O'Brien, the Carpenters drummer, really insightful. You know, he's still playing. He's the drummer for Bernadette Peters all over the
place. Yes.
So it's a nice mix of people who knew them and worked with them, but then also these younger voices and people who were inspired by their music.
That's wonderful. I have a question here from, let's see, Randy, did you ever interview Stephen Levenkron?
Levenkron. I never did. We exchanged a couple of emails here and there, but he's been, it seems to me as he used to give interviews in the 1990s and was on a lot of, you know, like the Inside Editions and things like that. And then it just stopped. And I still have never heard whether that was a deliberate thing from him. Like he said, I'm not going to do anymore. I kind of doubt it. I think that he may have signed an agreement with Richard Carpenter and the Carpenter family, similar to what Karen's husband, Tom Burris, we haven't really got to touch on just yet. But, you know, that marriage that she had was such a disaster. And the Carpenter family wanted to shut down anything that he might do. So I have spoken with Tom back before I knew a lot of things that Frenda told me about him. And when I really thought that I wanted him to have his chance to tell his side of the story kind of thing. And
you weren't able to publish anything.
Well, yeah, he said, I could talk to you till I was blue in the face about the Carpenters' lawyers, which now I wish I'd given him the opportunity to. But no, it was after Frenda let me know how that all went down and what, you know, it really exacerbated Karen's illness, something that could have turned things around. You know, people saw her looking just glowing at her wedding, but had no idea what the next year was going to be like for her. And it's apparent then when you see her a year later and she's, you know, 85 pounds. And it's sad that all these things, the shelving of her solo album, the marriage, the failure of the marriage, like all of these things just kind of pushed down and crashed down on her near the end. And I don't think.
Oh, I mean, it's like dominoes at the very end. But, you know, all of that is chronicled in the book. And I love the fact that you really focus, as I try to do with these interviews, on her body of worth. And Randy, you did a great job. It's just
thank you so much.
I mean, I told you in a previous text message that this book gripped me. I just sat the other night and I was crying. It touched me, you know, at the sadness. I just felt at moments like, did she have anyone to reach out to? And I'm sure that she would have had you to reach out to.
So, well, I would have been honored, but you know, it's just an honor to be any part of her legacy and to be able to hopefully help bring to life this person that, as I said before, has not really been much more than the record company biography. There's not a three-dimensional person before this book. And, you know, I hope that it keeps on giving. And the fact that we're still talking about it 10, 11 years after it was published means a lot to me. And a lot of fans have told me that the book was closure for them. It wasn't the ending they wanted, obviously, but there was closure knowing what happened because there was such uncertainty over the years of what happened to her. And I think the book helps to answer a lot of those questions.
Well, everyone, the book once again is Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. We could go on for 2 hours, 3 hours, but I want to be respectful of Randy's time. He's a teacher, after all. You're teaching tomorrow?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
and all of you who tuned in tonight, I don't take for granted that you could have been anywhere else for the last hour. And the fact that all of you chose to spend it with us, it means the world to me. If this is your first time here at Richard Skipper Celebrates and you had a nice time this evening, please consider subscribing. Take a moment to look at some of the other people that I've celebrated and visit those interviews and check out the ones that are coming up. Hit the like button. If you did indeed like tonight's show, leave a comment. That helps with the ranking of this interview. And share this with your friends. You can hit the share button right here on YouTube. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. This is what you can do. You can go to your Facebook friends list and you can click on, let's say, the fourth name that pops up. And then you can go to Amazon.com and you can order two copies of this book. Keep one for yourself and send one to the fourth friend that pops up and let them know what they mean to you in your life. As a dear friend of mine says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And you never know what someone else is going through right now. And I always say, if you're going to be out in a boat, make sure that you bring a skipper along. Now, Randy, I'm going to leave the screen and I'm going to give you the final word. Anything that you want to say about anything that we talked about tonight that you want to expound upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's watching right now, I thank you for your time. You are a true gem. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. You know, I think all of this really started for me with a group on the internet back in the mid-90s. And I guess I'd like to use this time to say thank you to them, because a lot of these people I've known and been friends with now for 25 years. And the Carpenters music has, you know, brought all of us together from so many different walks of life and different countries. You know, people all over the world have this similar fondness for the Carpenters and their music. And I just want to say thank you to all of the people who along the way have, whether it was just shared an encouraging word, maybe shared an article or an interview that they had about the Carpenters, all of that comes together in a way that made that book possible. And I think in many ways it was a group effort, and I couldn't have done it without all of the Carpenters fans around the world. So a big thank you to them. And if you're interested in the book or have any questions for me, please look me up on social media. I'd be happy to continue the discussion and keep listening to the Carpenters.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.